Krishnim Budvakshanam Rajan Uvacha Vahito Guru Balireva Grahapati Kula Charyena Basita Vakshanam Rajan Uvacha Vahito Guru Shri Shuka Uvacha. Shri Shukadev Goswami said, Bali, Bali Maharaj, Evam, thus, Grihapati, the master of the household affairs, although guided by the priests, Kula Acharyena, by the family Acharya or guide, Pasitaha, being thus addressed, Tushnim, silent, Budva, becoming, Shanam, for a moment, Rajan, O King, Maharaj Parikshit, Uvacha, said, Avahita, after full deliberation, Gurum, unto his spiritual master. Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sri Shukadev Goswami said, O King Parikshit, when Bali Maharaj was thus advised by his spiritual master, Shukracharya, his family priest, he remained silent for some time, and then, after full deliberation, he replied to his spiritual master as follows. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur remarks that Bali Maharaj remained silent at a critical point. How could he disobey the instruction of Shukracharya, his spiritual master? It is the duty of such a sober personality as Bali Maharaj to abide by the orders of his spiritual master immediately, as his spiritual master had advised. But Bali Maharaj also considered that Shukracharya was no longer to be accepted as a spiritual master, for he had deviated from the duty of a spiritual master. According to Shastra, the duty of a guru is to take the disciple back home, back to Godhead. If he is unable to do so and instead hinders the disciple in going back to Godhead, he should not be a guru. Guru Nasa Shat Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 5, Verse 18. One should not become a guru if he cannot enable his disciple to advance in Krishna consciousness. The goal of life is to become a devotee of Lord Krishna so that one may be freed from the bondage of material existence. Chakva deham punar janmam naitimam eti sorajuna. The spiritual master helps the disciple attain this stage by developing Krishna consciousness. Now, Shukracharya had advised Bali Maharaj to deny the promise to Vamanadev. Under the circumstances, therefore, Bali Maharaj thought that there would be no fault if he disobeyed the order of his spiritual master. He deliberated on this point. Should he refuse to accept the advice of his spiritual master, or should he independently do everything to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead? He took some time. Therefore it is said, Tushnim Bhutvak Shanam Rajan Uva Chava Hito Gurum. After deliberating on this point, he described that Lord Vishnu should be pleased in all circumstances, even at the risk of ignoring the Guru's advice to the contrary. Anyone who is supposed to be a Guru but who goes against the principle of Vishnu Bhakti cannot be accepted as a Guru. If one has falsely accepted such a Guru, one should reject him. Such a Guru is described as follows. Gurudapya Valip Tasya karya karya majanataha utpata pratipanasya parichago vidiyate. Srila Jiva Goswami has advised that such a useless guru, a family priest acting as guru, should be given up, and that the proper bona fide guru should be accepted. I'll also read the introduction to this chapter. This is chapter 20. The introduction I'll read. Oh, excuse me. I see that it's... I'm not having another page of purport, if that's what you're saying. Oh, there's some more Sanskrit. Oh, I was thinking that's like, okay. Satkarma nipuno vripro mantra tantra visharadaha avaishnavo guru nasyad vaishnava svapacho guruhu. A scholarly brahmana, expert in all subjects of Vedic knowledge, is unfit to become a spiritual master without being a Vaishnava. But if a person born in a family of a lower caste is a Vaishnava, he can become a spiritual master. Padma Purana. Thank you, Prabhu. I'll read the summary of the chapter before proceeding. Chapter 20, Bali Maharaj Surrenders the Universe. The summary of this 20th chapter is as follows. Despite his knowledge that Lord Vamanadev was cheating him, Bali Maharaj gave everything to the Lord in charity, and thus the Lord extended his body and assumed a gigantic form as Lord Vishnu. After hearing the instructive advice of Shukracharya, Bali Maharaj became contemplative. Because it is his duty of a householder to maintain the principles of religion, economic development, and sense gratification, Bali Maharaj thought it improper to withdraw his promise to the brahmachari. To lie or fail to honor a promise given to a brahmachari is never proper, for lying is the most sinful activity. Everyone should be afraid of the sinful reactions to lying, for Mother Earth cannot even bear the weight of a sinful liar. The spreading of a kingdom or empire is temporary. If there is no benefit for the general public, such expansion has no value. Previously, all the great kings and emperors expanded their kingdoms with a regard for the welfare of the people in general. Indeed, while engaged in such activities for the benefit of the general public, eminent men sometimes even sacrificed their lives. It is said that one who is glorious in his activities is always living and never dies. Therefore, fame should be the aim of life, and even if one becomes poverty-stricken for the sake of good reputation, that is not a loss. Bali Maharaj thought that even if this brahmachari Vamanadev were Lord Vishnu, if the Lord accepted his charity and then again arrested him, Bali Maharaj would not envy him. Considering all these points, Bali Maharaj finally gave in charity everything he possessed. Lord Vamanadev then immediately extended himself into a universal body. By the mercy of Lord Vamanadev, Bali Maharaj could see that the Lord is all-pervading and that everything rests in his body. Bali Maharaj could see Lord Vamanadev as the Supreme Vishnu, wearing a helmet, yellow garments, the mark of Srivatsa, the Kostuba jewel, a flower garland, and ornaments decorating his entire body. The Lord gradually covered the entire surface of the world, and by extending his body, he covered the entire sky. With his hands, he covered all directions, and with his second footstep, he covered the entire upper planetary system. Therefore, there was no vacant place where he could take his third step. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimate Jayapataka Swamini Tinamini. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swamini Tinamini. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschacha Desha Tarini. Hare Krishna. So, I'm very happy to have heard many lectures from the previous chapter because it's brought a lot of light to this chapter that's now following. In the previous chapter, Shukracharya had placed many arguments to Bali Maharaj, even up to the point of being deceitful and going back on his word. And he uses an argument that Krishna Archanamachati had brought up yesterday, that you had not said Om before making this statement. Therefore, Om is Om. If you say the word Om, that statement can be truthful, because Om signifies that you are not materially attached. So if you offer to give something, the fact that you're not materially attached or materially motivated allows you to fulfill that promise. So since you did not say Om, then you can go back on these words. In the second instruction, it's the second instruction of the Nectar of Instruction, there are six activities which can destroy one's spiritual life. That begins with achahara. So achahara is the overeating or unnecessarily collecting for things that are not required. So this is a materially minded person. You're working for consuming more than you need. And this is a human condition. In the animal kingdom, this doesn't happen. Srila Prabhupada gives an analogy that if you put a sack of rice in a field, a bird will come and take just enough as it needs and flies away. And all the animals will continue to do that. Whereas a human being, if they see that sack of rice, that sack of grains, they will eat until they're completely full and cannot eat anymore, and then keep the rest for later for themselves. So this tendency to acquire more than necessary and keep it for future times, the notion that we are independent and we must act to take care of ourselves, where by nature, animals are naturally dependent on nature, on the Lord, without being conscious of that. Whereas our consciousness is to act independently, so we're trying to acquire for ourselves. And thus comes the following thing which destroys spiritual life, which is prayasa. So prayasa is the unnecessary over-endeavor that comes with collecting more than is required. And thus we have all these modern inventions and schemes, which is occupying almost all of our time. And that is even causing us significant trouble. And another example can be used with the bird. So a bird is an animal, and it has natural defense mechanism. Srila Prabhupada uses this example, that a bird can simply fly away if it's in danger. Very easily, if a car is coming at a bird, it can simply fly away. And birds, very easy to eat. They can fly to wherever they need and get their food. And they can sleep pretty much anywhere. They can fly and find a safe place to sleep. And mating is simple for birds because they are simply associating freely with the opposite sex. Whereas the human being in this modern world, we're endeavoring significantly to do these things. So the human life is used for this material purpose. One must go through great endeavor, better to get an animal body, and Krishna can fulfill that desire. So next comes the little further down, one of the things is called Niyamagraha. Now Niyamagraha, so in the Sanskrit sandhi, the and a, like a short a and a long a, can be put together and it just forms a longer a, right? We've seen this. So niyamagraha is actually a dual word. It's created from niyama agraha and niyama agraha. So that single word niyamagraha, Both of those words combine to form the word niyamagraha. And this has a dual meaning. One meaning is an unnecessary, or it's following the rules and regulations of scriptures only for the sake of following them and not for the sake of spiritual advancement. And then the other version is to completely disregard spiritual rules and regulations or reject them and just act whimsically or independently. So in this context, Shukracharya is giving Bali Maharaj an instruction that you did not say Om before making the statement that you're going to give everything to Vamanadev. So this attachment to the rules that you did not say Om, therefore you don't have to follow this instruction. However, there's the second part, for the sake of spiritual advancement. If you consider the situation, what Om signifies is that the person is detached, is materially detached. And anyone who can see Bali Maharaj with a clear and proper vision will see that he is truly detached. Therefore, the need to say Om is not necessary. It's clear by his activities. It's clear by his state of mind, by his consciousness, and his interaction with Vamanadev. So, Shukracharya, unfortunately, due to his material attachment, is under the influence of Niyamagraha, by my estimation. And Bali Maharaj, when he receives these instructions, I'll read the translation one more time. Sri Shukadev Goswami said, O King Parakshit, when Bali Maharaj was thus advised by his spiritual master Shukracharya, his family priest, he remained silent for some time, and then after full deliberation, he replied to his spiritual master as follows. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says that if the spiritual master gives you an instruction, you should immediately act on those instructions without doubt. However, the situation Bali Maharaj is in is that the instructions of his spiritual master are subject to some scrutiny because based on those instructions, he could possibly be rejected. And Bali Maharaj, he neither acts whimsically nor does he act blindly by following some rules and regulations without the understanding of the spiritual context, of its spiritual significance. So he does decide to reject the instructions of his spiritual master. In a previous purport, Srila Prabhupada had referred to Shukracharya as a smarta brahmana. So the smarta brahmana is very knowledge in the rules and regulations. However, Prabhupada often paints them in a negative light in that they're doing it for some material means, for some material reason. So we can see in this situation with the presence of Vamanadev, both Bali Maharaj and Shukracharya are being tested. It's a test. Bali Maharaj is given the opportunity to surrender everything to the Supreme Lord. Similarly, Shukracharya is given the opportunity to... Shukracharya knows that Vamanadeva is appearing as the Supreme Lord. He's given the opportunity to take to real religion and see what's happening there. So we can see that there's a difference in their consciousness. And when the situation arises, that when Vamanadeva appears, that Shukracharya remains attached to these material concepts of he's placing them above the highest goal, which is to surrender to the Supreme Lord. Whereas Bali Maharaj is on a platform where he can see beyond friend and enemy and beyond these material things. Because his own grandfather is Prahlad Maharaj, and Prahlad Maharaj says, Punar Puna Charvita Charvana Nam, again and again chewing the chewed. So Balaram Maharaj can see that, okay, I cannot give Vamanadev, or this, in this case, not even knowing he's a Supreme, I could not give this Brahmachari Brahmin all my wealth, and I can rule the kingdom. But this kingdom has been ruled by millions before me, and it will be ruled by millions after me. So what use is for me to chew this chewed when I have this opportunity to surrender to the Supreme Lord? So he takes that opportunity to surrender. This is, in this context, I find that how we can relate to it, because this is a very extreme situation. And I'm thinking that one way that I was able to reflect on this is that the state of consciousness one is in while performing devotional service, as Jordan had brought up in his lecture, he emphasizes, so I've been meditating on this recently, that our consciousness that we're putting into it is very important. Because we can see when the Lord comes, it's often unexpected. And the trials that one experiences are often unexpected. So in this case, Balaram Maharaj has the entire three worlds, and he's performing his duties as a king, and here he is to give all that up suddenly. And he was prepared to make that decision due to his state of consciousness. We can see that while two people, him and Shukracharya, are involved in similar activity, the state of consciousness is different. And even prior to this, we can see with the churning of the milk ocean that the demigods had a different state of consciousness than the demons. So when the demons were, when the nectar was flowing, the various opulences were flowing from the milk ocean, they became distracted. Even from their very material goal of acquiring the nectar itself, the nectar of immortality, which is a material goal, they were even distracted by that, by Mohini Murti, so they didn't even achieve their material goals because their consciousness is flickering. So I was thinking, how can one apply this and the subtleties of Niyamagraha and what kind of impact that has on us? In that Balaram Maharaj, before making a decision, he thinks about it and acts based on religious principle. So similarly, we need to do this. And what adds to the picture is something that Nityananda Prahn had mentioned, that we also must act based on our adhikara, our qualification. So to make it clear, I'll have to give an example because this is difficult for me to articulate. We should follow rules and regulations, and we should understand the spiritual meaning behind it. And whether or not we fully understand the spiritual meaning behind it, if that rule and regulation is coming from someone who we are taking shelter of, from the spiritual master, or from our seniors, then it should also be followed. So this is a rare case where Balaram Maharaj is rejecting the instructions of a spiritual master to follow a higher principle. And he is one of the 12 Manvantaras, so he has the adhikar, the qualification to do this. And still, that being said, what got him to the point of controlling the three worlds is by following the instructions of his spiritual master. Shukracharya, yes. So by following those instructions from the same spiritual master he comes to reject, he actually got to this point. So it takes a very strong qualification. So we have to be careful. So I'll give some like simple examples to help relate this. One rule, and it's even written on the prasadam stall there, is that please wash your hands and mouth before honoring prasad, right? So generally, or before honoring prasad and after honoring prasad even. So generally, well, always, we wash our hands and wash our mouth and then honor the prasad, right? Allow me to finish. So one may say, well, conceptually, by my material conception, you know, my mouth is not touching the prasad. So I wash my hands. What's the difference? Right? So one may compromise the rule by their own conception, right? So they're acting whimsically because they don't have a full understanding why am I washing my mouth, right? It's not that maybe there's not a full understanding. It's this tongue that's honoring the prasad, so it should also be clean. Something like this. I don't have a full understanding. But one may compromise, right? So one may compromise in that, well, for some time they don't wash their mouth before honoring prasad, right? And then the mind's involved because they're following the mind instead of the instructions of the spiritual master, right? And then later, well, I have two hands. So if one hand is dirty, then I can serve with the clean hand and then honor with, you know, the muchi hand, like this. So one thing leads to another when one's taking shelter of the mind and his own conceptions. So we can see that this will happen when if we allow space for the mind, which is not qualified to instruct us in spiritual life, then it can slowly lead us down the wrong path. Similarly, if we're following instructions strictly, or on the other hand, I guess I should say, if we're following instructions very strictly, but we don't have a proper conception of why we're doing it, then when we become tested by Krishna, we may not be prepared to make the higher conscious choice. So for instance, oftentimes services may come to us unannounced. So internally, if we're not conscious of what our purpose is when they come, I guess for me, I'm sorry, it's a bit difficult. For me, this is where I can relate to not being conscious. It's where things happen unexpectedly. And this happens when different services come or when things happen that are out of our control. Then we're being tested. And generally, the consciousness that we're in before that happens is a strong indicator of how we're able to respond to that situation. For instance, this clear example, when Vamanadeva comes to Bali Maharaj, Bali Maharaj is conscious of the ultimate goal when he's following the instructions of his spiritual master, the ultimate goal being complete surrender unto the Supreme Lord. And then when that opportunity comes, he takes that opportunity. Whereas Shukracharya, up to that point, his instructions were helping Bali Maharaj come to that point. But when Krishna came in the form of Vamanadeva, Shukracharya's consciousness was still on the material platform. So his instructions were false. So one's consciousness is important. The externals can all be there, but when the rubber hits the road, if the consciousness is not in the right place, then when one must use their spiritual intelligence, Krishna will either give them the spiritual intelligence or the material intelligence. We're in one pool or the other. So even though externally we may be practicing Krishna consciousness or devotional service, we're performing it, the internal consciousness must also be there. So, I wanted to carry that point. Please forgive me. I don't have a note for it, so it's harder for me to articulate that. So if internally, there's Krishna has three energies. There's the internal potency, the antaranga shakti, then there's the external potency, the baharanga shakti, and then we are the marginal potency. So the internal potency, when one is surrendered to serving Krishna completely and consciously, then one's guided by Krishna's internal potency, yoga maya. And all of our activities are in the service of Krishna. There's constant absorption and loving ecstasy in the service of Krishna. In the external potency, this is manifest in the material world, Mahamaya. With our consciousness is, if we take shelter of that, then our consciousness is being controlled by the external potency. So we become more entangled in this material world, which can also be as much bewildering because it's Krishna's energy. And it's our choice which energy we're taking shelter of. In either case, we're not independent. We're either taking shelter of Krishna's internal potency or Krishna's external potency. So yesterday, when Marcel had asked, Shukracharya, is he bewildered? And Krishna Arjuna gave the answer that yes, he's entangled in his material concept of life and his material desires. So he's indeed bewildered by Krishna's external potency. As Marcel likes to say, he's moted out. So, when we're engaged in devotional service, I can speak for myself that the mind is so conditioned to taking shelter of the external material nature. It's so conditioned to take shelter of the senses. It's so conditioned to take shelter of its patterns of thought, of I must secure for myself, or I must do this, I must plan. The mind is constantly planning to preserve itself, this false ego. So when we can still take shelter of those patterns, though we're externally engaged in devotional service. And we have this very great opportunity because we're in the association of Vaishnavas that we can constantly work on this because we are engaged in devotional service. So we have that constant reminder of what's really important. So because we have that constant reminder of what's really important, we can work and bring the mind into that process as well. And that's the real work, I think. That's the real work. The devotional service we're getting is Krishna's mercy. It's, you know, we don't deserve it, but we're privileged to perform this devotional service. So from our end, we can carry our minds into that service. When we were in the mode of ignorance, one is doing irreligious activities and thinking that they are religious. This is a faith in the mode of ignorance. So one is unconsciously incompetent. They're perfectly satisfied doing things incorrectly. Then when we come to this process of Krishna consciousness, we start to become consciously incompetent. We start to realize, wow, I've been doing things wrong. My frame of mind is wrong. I'm putting myself in the center. I'm thinking that I'm the controller. And slowly we become consciously competent because we're receiving instructions from the spiritual master and we're receiving instructions from our peers and our seniors. So we get a proper understanding of what is correct. So we can consciously perform those activities competently. And this is the Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti stage of devotional service. We become more and more aware of our incompetence, and we endeavor more and more to become consciously competent in our activities. And by Krishna's mercy, we eventually become unconsciously competent, or we become fully realized in our natural position as servant of Krishna. And that the purpose of our existence is to be enjoyed by Krishna. And that becomes spontaneous. So we're working to that point of unconscious competence. And to get there, we must first be consciously competent. So when that opportunity arises that Krishna is giving us, we can take full advantage of them. Thank you for being patient. It took me some time to express these points, and I hope this was of some value. If there are any questions or comments...
Thank you. I like the points that you're making relating to the nectar of instruction. Specifically how we engage in devotional service. I really like the point that if we're engaged in the improper consciousness, then when we become tested, when we get challenged, then it'll show. I thought that was a good point. And I have a question also. I'm wondering why, if Bali Maharaj is the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, if he has this higher understanding from Prahlad Maharaj, I'm wondering why he's considered Shukracharya, his spiritual master. I'm wondering why he didn't, in the first place, just take shelter of Prahlad Maharaj completely.
Honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. I can speculate, but... My speculation, if I may, in his heart he was... here, someone knows the answer. The question is, if Bali Maharaj is the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, and Prahlad Maharaj is a self-realized soul suitable to be a spiritual master, why did he not simply take shelter of his instructions? Why is he accepting Shukracharya as his spiritual master, though we're coming to find out that Shukracharya is not on the same level as Prahlad Maharaj?
Bali Maharaj, being the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, was considered a daitya, or demon, by birth. Prahlad Maharaj, although taking birth as well in the family of daityas, demons, was a very, very exalted Vaishnava. So Bali Maharaj, being the grandson and descendant of Prahlad Maharaj, knew that Prahlad Maharaj was an exalted Vaishnava. And yes, Bali did inherit Vaishnava qualities and behavior from Prahlad Maharaj. But because Bali was installed as the king of the daityas, therefore externally he had to act in that capacity as a king. Internally, he's Vaishnava, because a Vaishnava has nothing to do with birth. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu pointed out to Ramananda Roy, Kiba Vipra, Kiba Nyasi, Shudra, Kene Noi, Ye Krishna Tattva Veta, Se Guru Hoy. That a Vaishnava can literally take birth in any condition. And we can see that practically, even members of our Dasilva succession took birth in so many different circumstances, all the varnas, all the ashramas, because this is the Lord's arrangement to give encouragement to every section of society. So therefore, the Vaishnavas sometimes take birth as brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaisyas, shudras, brahmacharis, grihastas, vanaprastha, and sannyasis. And sometimes a Vaishnava would take birth in a line that is considered demoniac. But it doesn't mean to say that that personality is demoniac. So Bali took birth in a line coming from Hiranyakashipu, who was one of the greatest demons, asuras, in history. But on account of Prahlad Maharaj's presence, yes, Bali internally inherited those Vaishnava qualities. But because he was installed as a king of the demons, he externally acted accordingly. Now, why did he accept Shukracharya as his spiritual master? Shukracharya is a spiritual master for all of the demons, all of the daityas, not just Bali. So it was just an external, superficial arrangement. And now that it is seen that Shukracharya is discouraging Bali, do not give anything to this boy, Vamana. He is the personality of Godhead. Now we see that Bali will reject Shukracharya. Oh, you're not fit to be a spiritual master. So sometimes a Vaishnava is duty-bound to adhere to certain superficial arrangements within society. Like, for example, we're now living in a day and age where non-devotees of the Lord are in charge. So they're encouraging meat-eating, slaughtering of innocent animals, intoxication, abortions, and devotees of the Lord do not have the same prominence, so to speak, to make a very dynamic alternative solution. We have the process, we have the means, but unfortunately the devotees of the Lord are not being given prominence. So sometimes a Vaishnava is duty-bound to adhere to different secular rules, regulations. But soon as there is some deficiency, then the Lord makes arrangements for things to be adjusted properly. So Bali could have easily taken shelter of Prahlad Maharaj, but again, because he is the king, he was duty-bound to just follow the external secular system of rules and regulations. But now in this section of the Bhagavatam, you'll see Bali's Vaishnava tendencies becoming more and more prominent. Both Prahlad as well as Bali are Mahajans. So we should never think that Bali Maharaj is an ordinary personality or out of touch. Swayambhu Narada Shambhu, Kumara Kapila Manu, Prahlado Janako Bhishmo, Bali Vyasaki Vayam. These are the prominent Mahajans or authorities in devotional service. So Bali Maharaj is counted amongst these great devotees.
Hare Krishna, you very eloquently and thoroughly confirmed my speculation. Thank you. Thank you, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thank you for your class. My question is kind of related to all of the points. Like a Vaishnava could be born in any family in Niyamagraha. So there's one quote I heard in this regard. It says, Benjamin Franklin said something nice. He says, it takes many good deeds to build a good reputation, and only one bad deed to ruin it all. And that same quote could also be applied to all our relationships, the dilemma Bali Zen. And we can see that in everyday life. Like, it takes many agreements to build a good relationship, and only one disagreement to ruin it all. So our situation is kind of like Bali, is that sometimes we have a dilemma that if I disagree with one party or over the other, then I may ruin one or the other relationship. And so my question is kind of related to that point, is that the tendency is that as far as your Niyamagraha point is concerned, we see in the scriptures that when we hear the word pure devotee, it's not a black and white thing. When we look at Lord Shiva in the Mohini situation, or Bilbo Mango Thakur, he ran after prostitutes, or even in the Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 11, Verse 19, that whole verse talks about prostitutes, and even at purport, Prabhupada's glorifying that even prostitutes, somehow or other, they're obliged to accept that profession, still they're unalloyed devotees if they take to Krishna Bhakti. So, from an external point of view, or the literal brahmana, we can't, since we're so attached to the rules and regulations, if you don't have great knowledge in Sanskrit or the scriptures, you're not an authority. If you're a former prostitute, that means you're a prostitute, branded a prostitute for your entire life. So we can see that's the situation is that that goes on. We're conditioned souls. We see externally, we can't appreciate that a Vaishnava could be born in any family. So from my question is related from two perspectives. As a leadership position, if we somehow other come to a leadership position, official, how detrimental is it for us to feel like if someone doesn't listen to us, then I control their reputation. If you don't listen to me, then I'll tell everyone, you know, you're not a devotee or whatever. Because, or in from a let's say you're accepting instruction, maybe not officially, because many people give us instruction involuntarily. And sometimes the tendency is you don't want to commit Vaishnava or Parah, but you already have your own Shiksha Gurus you place your faith in. And so from both perspectives, how should one disposition be as a leadership position? And like, not to come to the understanding that I have control over people's reputation, because we could see like the prostitutes, Lord Shiva, Mohini Murti form, or so many pastimes, is that although these devotees are normally considered degraded or won't have a good reputation, if the Lord controls your reputation, then it doesn't matter what your past is. The Lord could glorify you. So how important is it for us from a leadership position to not think that we have control over people's reputation if they don't listen to us, our enlightened decision? And also from a student perspective, that what should our disposition be if we don't want to ruin reputation, our relationship, or commit Vaishnava Parah? So I hope you assimilate that question to the best of my ability. I explained it, so maybe you could elaborate on those points a little.
You made an interesting point about, in terms of relationships. First, you made a point about relationships, and then about what that implies for a leader. So in relationships that one disagreement, like you said, can have a significant impact on a relationship. And you mentioned that it's our conditioned nature. And so indeed, this is the age of quarrel. And so naturally, we're expert disagreeers. And in terms of what makes Krishna consciousness uniquely transcendental and special is that the things that we are in agreement on is truth. And so that's why in the midst of significant disagreements that are occurring regularly, The simple truth that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and our eternal, transcendental, constitutional position is in His loving service. That one truth so powerfully holds us together amidst so many disagreements, that's why we're here, and that's why this is the greatest benediction for all humankind. The implication of that for leaders in this movement, the six foremost leaders in this movement are the six Goswamis. And they're Goswamis because they are masters of the senses. And they have, in one of the prayers for the Goswamis, is that they are non-envious. Because they themselves are completely non-envious of the Supreme Lord and of all living entities. They can associate and intermingle with even rascals and miscreants, and even those people feel love and affection for them and the desire to serve them in serving the Lord. And all the leaders in our movement, all of our acharyas, our founder acharya Srila Prabhupada, they carried this mood of this sincere, humble service to the Supreme Lord, this completely void of envy. It's a quality of character that the leaders have, and they're leaders because they have that quality of character. And for us, simply by associating with them and following their instructions, we also will develop that quality of character. Something Jitendriya Prabhu had said the other day is, it's in Bhagavad Gita that, what is it? No endeavor in this material world is without fault. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, even though the fire produces smoke, we still have to perform the yajna. So our activities are not perfect, but that internal position of the leader is far beyond any external lapse. So when we're judging based on externals and this little disagreement and that little disagreement, however significant they may appear, we are united in that humble service to Krishna. And one example of Radhanath Swami, he says very often he apologizes for things he did not do. I've heard someone has told me that he does this, that he simply apologizes and asks for forgiveness for something. If someone's hurt, he apologizes and asks forgiveness for that. Krishna himself did this. When Draupadi, her sari was being removed, and she was praying to Krishna, help me Krishna, help. Finally she prayed to Krishna, she surrendered to Krishna. And Krishna came in the form of her sari by becoming longer and longer and longer so that she could not be disrobed. Draupadi was not aware that Krishna had come in that form. And when she saw Krishna, she said, Krishna, why didn't you come and help me? Assuming that he hadn't. And he said, please forgive me. He didn't say, I did come and help you. Yeah. So, does this help? Yes, Prabhu.
This is in regards to your point about having your internal consciousness be in the right place versus your external actions. So, quite often you hear, the internal consciousness should be, I'm doing this for Krishna. But quite often, I don't know if I'm doing it for Krishna. I don't know what it means, because you hear it all the time. You just do it for Krishna. You should be doing this in the right consciousness. Make sure your consciousness is right. But how am I supposed to know if I'm actually doing it for Krishna? Because, for example, I may be doing the pots one morning, and when I start, okay, I'm doing it for Krishna, you know, whatever that means, I'm doing it for Krishna, and then, you know, we start doing it, and then after some time, that is gone, and I'm, you know, it's not the forefront of my focus, because my focus is in the service, so I'm a little confused about what it means to have the internal consciousness be in the right place. Can you help me understand?
Srila Prabhupada was very practical. I've heard him often glorified as being a very practical devotee of the Lord. One external indicator that we're doing well is that the spiritual master is pleased. And internally, one can be practical. This is one solution, is by being practical. From experience, I can give an example. I was trained by morning transfer service by Rakdak Prabhu, and it's a very nice service. He trained me nicely. And one thing, after he trained me in the service and all the practical measures, he said, "Remember, this is for Krishna." And he says that, that's what makes this service complete, is that you're doing this for Krishna. And the first few times I was doing that service, I was very much absorbed in the fact that, wow, I'm touching Krishna's plates and this is for Krishna. And then it shifted where my mind was distracted. I took it for granted. They say familiarity breeds contempt. You don't always remember that the pots we're washing belong to Krishna. So then I became more practical, and I can be conscious of the practical elements of it, how to have it very efficient in doing it very properly in a practical way. I'm conscious of doing it practically well. So the consciousness that one has where, wow, this is for Krishna, and you really feel that it's for Krishna, that experience, by my understanding, is coming from Krishna. We're not necessarily in control. That's the mercy of our association, that we really understand and feel, wow, this is for Krishna. It's good to be conscious of that. Now, if that's not happening, we can be practical. So the practical element is, how can I do this service very nicely? And that's helped me focus on that fact that this is for Krishna. Because if it was for me, you know, I don't care how the prasadam lands on my plate. I'm like, woo, Hare Krishna. Yeah? But it's Krishna's plate, so I care practically that I'm doing it nicely. So in terms of something as simple as washing pots, if we're fully conscious and doing that thoroughly, and doing it properly and carefully, I mean, just to be explicit about it, like sometimes people, more than one occasion, people can complain that we put the pots down too loudly because it's metal on metal. So if we're just like clink, right, then we're disturbing the brahmanas who are cooking for Krishna, right? Not, or other people who are in the area, right? It's a loud, like clanky noise, which can be disturbing, huh? So we can put things down gently and carefully, like practically, like if you stack the pots here, if you arrange the spoons here, you know. And that, it's amazing how fully absorbed we can be in these simple things, that we're doing things properly for Krishna. So this is one tool that's helped me. And then you will experience Krishna's mercy, its mode of goodness. cultivating mode of goodness is very pleasing to Krishna. Krishna is favorable to mode of goodness. So doing things carefully and consciously is in the mode of goodness. And then Krishna reciprocates. You feel the ecstasy of, wow, I did that service nicely. You feel enthusiasm. This is a good symptom, I think, that Krishna is pleased. You feel enthusiastic for your services. It's that you, when you're doing it carefully and consciously, you feel enthusiastic about washing the pots. And then when you finish, you actually have more energy than when you started. So then you're enthusiastically moving to the next task. And then you can carry that enthusiasm by being conscious and careful in the other activities we're doing. Does this help? Maybe someone else can... So... This is, from my, I guess, realization, this is what helped me. Does that help, Prabhu? Srila Prabhupada... Oh,
without giving a very elaborate answer, we should always remember service to Krishna includes service to the Vaishnavas. So if we're endeavoring to satisfy our spiritual master and the devotees of the Lord, then by pleasing them, we're automatically pleasing Krishna. So Krishna includes devotees. Just as in Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a wonderful conversation between Lord Shiva and his consort, Parvati. And on one occasion, Parvati Devi asked Lord Shiva, there are so many worshipful personalities. Whom do you consider to be the supreme object of worship? And Lord Shiva immediately said, Aradhananam Sarvesham. Out of all types of worshipful personalities, Vishnu. Adadyate Padam. Vishnu, or the personality of Godhead, Krishna, is the supreme worshipful object. Then Lord Shiva said, but there's one more point to consider. Tadhyanam Samacharam. To worship those things that in relationship to the Supreme Lord is considered higher. So indirectly, Lord Shiva was indicating that to worship the devotees of the Lord, those who are worthy of worship, because there are different classifications of devotees. But the idea is that if we can please the exalted, pure devotees of the Lord, automatically Krishna is pleased. So we don't need to make an internal mental adjustment. Am I pleasing Krishna? If we're pleasing the devotees of the Lord, our authorities, devotees in general, our spiritual master, then we can understand we're pleasing Krishna. Krishna includes his devotees. Prabhupada would say, Krishna is never alone. If you see a painting of Krishna alone, Prabhupada said that it isn't bona fide. Krishna is always surrounded by devotee associates.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Panchakopa tubas chakrapa sindhu bheva cha patitanam pavane pyo vaishnave pyo namo namaha.
But the grass is even devotees. No, he's with his devotees in the grass, the conscious. I was thinking about like, some pictures I like that where Krishna's alone, but I'm like, grass is the devotees and they're conscious in the spiritual world. Everything's supposed to be conscious. So.
Thanks much for that class.
You're welcome.
Oh, very nice. Thank you so much.
You trained him well, grasshopper. Now he's the student has become the master.